You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as insight and analysis into all the topics you're discussing in football. I mean, McGarry, and with me as always is Duncan Castles. We're going to get straight to the news, as we like to do. And Duncan, some interesting developments in the potential transfer of RB Leipzig's German striker, Timo Werner.
Yeah, we've told you in the podcast that Werner is one of the strong candidates for that attacking reinforcement that Manchester United have prioritised in the January window after making such a mistake by letting Lukaku go and being very dependent and one-dimensional in the type of fast attackers with no sort of reference point forward. We've also told you that Liverpool are very keen on Werner and have started negotiations with his camp over transfer. Can tell you that Manchester United sent their head of global scouting, Marcel Boot, to Germany at the weekend to watch the Hertha Berlin Leipzig match, and specifically to run his eye over Werner in that game. It's a match in which Werner scored Leipzig's opening goal, their equaliser in 38 minutes from the penalty spot, and one of their final goals in the 4-2 victory right at the end of the game. So performed well. And the decision, I think, has to be made on Werner and whether they can persuade him that Manchester United is a better place for him to go than Liverpool. Also, whether they could persuade Leipzig to allow him to leave in January. There is a release clause. I'm told it's quite a complex arrangement. I'm also told that Werner is looking for an extremely high salary when he does make his move away from the Bundesliga. The figure I'm hearing is of 300,000 a week is the figure that's being floated as the price to secure him, obviously conscious that he has both Manchester United and Liverpool, two of the most affluent clubs in football, pursuing him. And Ian, I think you've got some further information on United's options to fix the attacking problems they have.
Indeed, Duncan. Obviously, their interest in Mario Mandzukic stretches back to the summer. And interesting, their interest also in Erling Braut Haaland is also very much alive. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been consulting with his coaching staff and also with Manchester United's rather large array of recruitment specialists. His particular worry for the second half of the season is the lack of conversion rate of both Anthony Martial and Marcus Rashford, something I think in terms of Rashford specifically we saw in the second half against Brighton Hove Albion last Sunday, when he could have had as many as six goals but missed a handful of very good opportunities that he could have certainly converted. Now, to that end, Mandzukic would be your better bet. And I think Solskjaer admits this, certainly has spoken to his coaches about it. Very experienced striker, age of 32, international, obviously has won trophies at the highest level. However, Mandzukic comes with a high salary as well as a €12 million transfer fee and will want a reasonably long contract to make the move. We've also discussed in the pod, as you will all remember, Mandzukic isn't the easiest character in a dressing room if he's not getting things his way or he doesn't feel the love. So Solskjaer has is the choice potentially between that kind of difficulty with a senior player but who is proven, or with Haaland, who's currently playing and playing very well, admittedly, at RB Salzburg in the Austrian League. He's only 19. He has a personal relationship with Solskjaer, having been coached by him at Molde in Norway. Haaland is available, although Salzburg would prefer if he was sold that he'd be loaned back to them for the rest of the season. But of course, he's not proven on the big stage. So it's that you can see the bigger picture here. United juggling a lot of balls with regards to strikers. Werner, Haaland, Mandzukic. They have turned down the opportunity to re-sign Zlatan Ibrahimovic. That was offered to them by Mino Raiola. So clearly, they don't want to go backwards. But I think if Solskjaer's... his problem in terms of the goals that Manchester are not scoring, and Duncan, I think it's at 16-4 in the Premier League already this season and 12 against.
Yeah, correct.
So you can see that has been a problem for them, especially with the way that they are struggling to climb the table. So it's going to be very, very busy for Manchester United in terms of trying to negotiate deals for each of these players, because of course what happens in these situations is you try to put a deal in place for everyone and then you don't choose the striker you want or the one that's the best value or the best bet. So yes, expect to see a lot of movement in terms of Manchester United and strikers over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
Just 16 goals, we've got to remember that Manchester United had an extraordinary number of penalties this season already. They've missed a lot of those penalties, but they've also scored a lot of those penalties. So the goal scoring from open play is poor. Mandzukic is a player who is definitely available because Juventus want him off their books. He has an offer from Qatar, as we told you on the podcast a few weeks ago, which he's intimated that he would like to take. In those circumstances, Juventus would subsidise part of his wages. You've got to factor in, as Solskjaer, if you take Mandzukic, not only his personality and the difficulty of managing him as a player who expects to be in the first team, you'd have to factor in that he hasn't played football this season. He's been sidelined from Juventus's Champions League squad, sidelined from their team. So you're taking a older player, albeit one who has always kept himself in good condition in the past, who is not match fit in the terms of having played club football. So that is going to be an additional risk there. But it is a central focus for Manchester United, and they've been doing a lot of work on this teeing up deals. And as you say, the United's way is to set up multiple deals at the same time before deciding which one of those they want to trigger as the first choice.
We should also note, Duncan, on that potential difficulty of Mandzukic's fitness, that Juventus have said to United, and this is how desperate they are to get rid of the player, if we can reach a deal before January, the 1st, obviously when he has to be registered, he can come and train with you in December so that he is up to match sharpness, or at least looks to have had a pre-season properly before he would have play his first game, presumably in January. So just lets you see just how desperate Juventus are to offload Mandzukic. Personally, I'd always be just slightly cynical if a club was that desperate to get rid of a player. Or at least, indeed, I'd have to be a club who was desperate to get a player. As I say, there will be developments, and of course, we'll bring you the news first here on the transfer window. Now, we're expecting some big news over the next few days, and possibly even later this afternoon. Remember, this is Friday's podcast regarding the financial fair play issues, which have been dogging Manchester City for some months now. Duncan, you have some interesting news regarding the adjudicatory panel, where UEFA have been deciding what a fate City should face if indeed they are proven to have been guilty of breaking FFP rules.
Yeah, so look, today we're expecting to hear a verdict from CAS on Manchester City's appeal against that process that UEFA have put in place. They've been investigated for financial fair play transgressions. The investigatory chamber made its conclusions some time ago and made its recommendations to the adjudicatory chamber that Manchester City should be banned from Champions League competition as a punishment for those transgressions, which have been very well documented in the press, documentary evidence, internal club emails of the way in which money was taken from Abu Dhabi's resources and put onto Manchester City's books in order to allow them to appear to comply with FFP rules earlier in this decade. That CAS verdict is about whether it was correct for UEFA to go through the process of making this decision. It's not actually an appeal against the decision that is taken because the decision has not been announced by the adjudicatory chamber. There was a report yesterday that UEFA have decided, i.e. the adjudicatory chamber has decided that Manchester City will not be banned, that they will ignore the recommendation from the investigatory group, and that the punishment would be of a financial nature, as it was the last time Manchester City were found guilty of breaching FFP, which was in 2014. Talk to contacts in UEFA about this. I have not been able to get a confirmation. I'm being told that this information is being held very tight by the governing body. My contacts have said it would not surprise them if they have caved in and decided not to take the risk of banning Manchester City with the legal ramifications that would have. Manchester City have made it quite clear that they will fight this as far as they can, and they will use the full resources of the Abu Dhabi state to ensure that they are not dealt with in a way that they are unhappy with, which would obviously be found guilty and being banned from the competition that Abu Dhabi want to win above all others in world football. What I'm also hearing is that three members of the investigatory chamber have resigned their positions from that group in recent months, and the implication is that that is connected with the UEFA's stance, not just on Manchester City, but definitely on Manchester City, as that is the high, you know, the highlight, the top case, and the one where the evidence has been most public, but also that Paris Saint-Germain managed to escape punishment on a technicality earlier this year, when they took their case to CAS. And also, I understand over the handling of AC Milan, who were banned from European competition this season, but banned from the Europa League rather than the Champions League, and the ban coming in a kind of an agreed settlement after both UEFA and Milan knew that Milan weren't going to be in the Champions League this year. So the suggestion is it was a compromise deal to get the punishment out of the way at a time when it would damage Milan less, because the money from the Europa League is nowhere near as significant as the money from the Champions League. So we wait for the official decision, and but there is a great, what is for sure is there is a great deal of turmoil within UEFA and within the people who have been involved in this process. And as we've said when examining this on the Transfer Window podcast from the very start, this was always a highly political and highly complex decision for UEFA to make, with at a time in which the future of the Champions League is in doubt, the future of whether UEFA retain control over the premier club competition for football's biggest and most affluent clubs, the push for the European Super League, which people like our friend Roger Mitchell, who is well connected in these circles, suggest is inevitably going to happen. And the debate is over who governs it, whether it's UEFA, whether it's FIFA, whether it's another body entirely. And as we said, the risks involved for UEFA in going head to head with one of the biggest and most important and most politically powerful players in football has been obvious for everyone to see.
Now, I'm also told, Duncan, that the cost that UEFA have already had to shell out in terms of legal fees and external lawyers, because UEFA, of course, have a very, very competent team of in-house lawyers. But because this case is so complex, they've already spent millions of euros in external legal consultation, and that there is a distinct feeling that if they were to pursue this further, and as you've already mentioned, Manchester City are prepared to go beyond any formal judgment by UEFA and by CAS, if it means that they get to pursue what they see as justice, that UEFA simply cannot afford to be embroiled in that kind of legal battle with the unlimited resources that Manchester City have behind them. Now, the implications and the consequences for financial fair play are very serious here, because effectively this will set a precedent where an investigation team and then a judicatory chamber between them had made a decision that Manchester City, let's just say, were to be banned. Now, this is hypothetical, of course. And then that decision was not carried through for the reasons that we've outlined. Then where does that leave financial fair play? Actually, it leaves it in ruins, because it shows that it can be defeated if you're willing to take it that far. And so City's case will always be cited by anyone else from now on who is charged with FFP transgressions. And they will then say, well, FFP was supposed to be, the very ethos of FFP was to make a more of a fairer playing field for every club to operate, so that super rich clubs like Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, etc., couldn't simply just spend what they liked and then win every trophy, etc., etc. So even small clubs now could say, well, you completely undermined your own rules. So, you know, what have we got to believe in with regards to FFP? And, you know, this is, remember, FFP was the brainchild and also the full manifesto of Michel Platini, who has since, of course, been banned from football, you know, in disgrace for receiving illegal payments from FIFA. So there may be some people at UEFA are thinking, do you know what? This is just too difficult. Just you know, it's not even our baby anymore. We're effectively carrying someone else's baby who has since been shown to have been corrupt. So why bother? And that will mean, of course, that we go back to the old system where clubs like PSG and City, not that they have, although City have behaved much better, Duncan, than PSG have in terms of excessive spending recently, we'll just buy whoever we like.
Yes, that is the implication. If Manchester City get away with a financial fine for a second time, then they will have broken financial fair play rules and broken them in an obvious and excessive fashion, which every other or almost every other club that they're competing with feels is a major breach of the competition rules. Because remember, financial fair play is central to Champions League competition, and every other club has been tasked with adhering to those rules and constraining the resources they're able to put onto the playing pitch by those rules. And you will have a circumstance, should they be found, either be found not guilty by the adjudicatory chamber or let off with a financial penalty as opposed to a actual ban from the competition, then they will have been seen to have broken FFP twice and been let off twice. So basically death knell for FFP as a central element of the competition rules in European competition. And remember,
there's a domino effect as well, Duncan, in terms of the undermining of the governing bodies, both FIFA and UEFA. Of course, both are currently involved in rather sensitive but very ambitious plans to expand the World Cup, to have a new World Club Championship, which has more teams in it, possibly even a World Super League in a non-World Cup year or a non-European Championship year, potentially, of course, funded by billions of petrodollars from the Gulf states. So it could be any one or more funding those new projects that both FIFA and UEFA are keen to get going and investing, because it makes a huge amount of revenue for them. So that you've got to say, like, it doesn't take a, you know, a genius to work out there could be a compromise here with regards to what's happening in the future and what's happening now. And when I mentioned domino effect, I also mean, of course, that on the 20th of November, so next week, Cass will hear Chelsea's case against the two-window transfer ban that they had been hit with last March. They chose not to contest the summer one, and then almost as a been claiming, well, we're good boys, we've done our time because we did one, but would you think about suspending the January one? And Chelsea are extremely confident, I'm told, of having that either suspended or overturned. So it seems like it could be a good week for the big boys in the Premier League with regards to getting around any kind of further sanction for their mis- and transgression of the rules, Duncan. But as we say,
yeah, and you know, look, let's remember what happened last time with FFP. We had Brian Quinn, who was a senior figure within UEFA, investigating Manchester City's breaches of FFP, at that point resigning his position after the decision was made to let them off lightly on that occasion. Here we have the three members of the investigatory chamber resigning around the time when a decision is due to be made on Manchester City. And, you know, the implications for football at a time in which Saudi Arabia, which is more affluent than Abu Dhabi and Qatar, is planning and thinking of buying one of the major clubs in European football are huge. Because if FFP goes, then there is no limit on how much money Abu Dhabi and Saudi Arabia and Qatar can put into their teams. And we return to the situation where Qatar can say, or Abu Dhabi, Kylian Mbappe is on the market, we will spend a record amount of money for that player and pump his salary up to a level which no one else is prepared to compete with, except in those circumstances you'd have three nation states all with similar resources competing for those players. So then you get the
and transfer already rivals fee. As well, Duncan, rivals in politics, rivals in their own part of the world, and now rivals in football.
Yes, and it's not hard to see what the inflationary outcome of that would be and what it would imply for clubs who have to depend on resources they can generate themselves to purchase players. What would happen to them in that situation where you get unfettered spending returning to football for Qatar, Abu Dhabi, and potentially Saudi Arabia thrown into that marketplace as well?
So let's have a little time capsule moment, Duncan. We're not going to dig this time capsule up in 50 years' time. I reckon it'll be 2 years' time, or maybe less. How much will Kylian Mbappe be getting paid to play for one of the multi-billion-air petrodollar clubs who will be involved in European football in, say, 1 year or 2 years' time?
His next contract, well, he can certainly, if I'm Kylian Mbappe's father...
And I bet you wish you were.
Where I had Real Madrid desperate to sign the player, and you know that Barcelona will probably come in and try if they've got the resources to do that. A Manchester United with new owners, potentially. He's probably out of Liverpool's reach, but Manchester City freed up to spend again. Look, 35 million net is Neymar's current basic salary. Messi managed to get himself a deal which was worth in the region of 50 million net when he blackmailed Barcelona with the idea that he was going to move to Manchester City and be paid by Abu Dhabi. And you have the senior politician in Abu Dhabi and chairman of Manchester City on record as saying that the transfer he regrets not doing was Lionel Messi's. You know, put yourself in that situation. I think I'd be asking for 50 million net as a starting point for Mbappe.
So equating to effectively around 90 or 100 million a year gross then?
Yes, basic salary, bonuses coming on top.
Well, their time capsule has been put into the Transfer Window podcast's garden. We will dig that up when Kylian Mbappe moves, and we'll see if our predictions were close or even spot on. Duncan, another issue that we have been very, very much all over on the back on, call it a cheap suit if you like, because it certainly feels that way, is VAR. Now, we spoke earlier in this week's podcast about the Premier League stakeholders meeting, which took place on Thursday of this week. And having spoken to two or three people who were present at that meeting, I'm told that Mike Riley began his presentation to the 20 stakeholders rather nervously, because he knew there were a lot of people in the room who were basically had their knives out ready to get him, but that he gave in the end, a very confident and competent presentation. The key statistic that he quoted, and one which, of course, the clubs couldn't really deny, or at least certainly could not ignore, was that the percentage of potentially match deciding decisions had gone up from, in terms of getting them right, that is, from 82% to 91% from last season to the first 12 matches of this season under VAR. So almost a tenth improvement. And that was the key stat, I'm told, which swayed clubs to avert themselves from going down the route of tabling a motion for suspension of VAR. Instead, they have agreed a very minimal course of changes, Duncan, which I'm sure you're aware of. Just let me read the statement, because yet another statement has come out from the Premier League now with regards to VAR. For those of you that haven't seen it, the implementation of VAR was discussed at length, and the Premier League and the Professional Game Match Officials Board committed to improving the consistency of decisions, speeding up processes, and increasing communication to fans. Duncan, is this enough, or is this just lip service? Because the fans, more than any, are the group of people who are, not just the fans, the referees as well as some of the clubs, the ones that I feel like this has been farcical and needs to change dramatically in order to improve.
Well, look, I think the key thing here is for anything to change, you had to have a two-thirds majority of Premier League clubs forcing that change upon Mike Riley. Beyond what he has offered, which is video screens instead of saying decision, VAR deciding on a penalty, it's going to say VAR deciding on a penalty, possible handball. I mean, great. That additional piece of information is really going to make a difference to satisfying fans in the stadium about delays and not seeing the process going on. I note that the Premier League state that they would like to show videos and suggesting that they would like to allow the communication between the referee and the VAR to be broadcast, but they're not allowed to do so because of the IFAB protocol. So they're kind of laying that off, which is ironic given they are ignoring a lot of the IFAB protocol in terms of not using pitch side monitors to allowing referees to go and look at them, and they have not changed their guidance on those, and that the referee should only look if he has is in significant disagreement with what he's been told by the VAR, i.e. his view of the event is radically different from that the VAR is giving, or unseen incidents is the other thing, whether they're saying they would allow a referee to go to the monitor. But of course, not one referee has gone to a monitor yet in all of the games we've seen so far. Some of the discussion that's come out from stakeholders, i.e. chairman, owners of clubs, I think indicates why that two-thirds majority was impossible to reach. I mean, you've got David Gold saying this is a brand new system. We just have to be a bit more patient. We will get it right. These are things that have got to improve. And that, to me, is very Anglo-centric. VAR is not a brand new system. VAR has been in football since the Confederations Cup before the last World Cup. And we've seen, in some domestic leagues, it's been in place. This is the third season in which it's been in place. So we've seen the errors and the mistakes and the controversies and the politics that go around it. So referees competing with each other, not being happy with someone that they're competing with for premium games, and FIFA appointments having the power to overrule them. And video has been a problem in Italy. We've seen all of this developing elsewhere. So the idea that it's a new system and it'll fix itself, I think, is just it's clearly not the case. It hasn't fixed itself elsewhere, so why should it fix itself here? And you know, the Premier League's argument in terms of VAR was, we will wait and watch what happens elsewhere and implement it better than anyone else because we will have learned from what they're doing. That clearly hasn't happened. So now to revert back to it's a new system and we'll get it right down the line is I think indicates that those sort of voices from people like David Gold are the ones who want it to work and haven't yet accepted that it isn't working. The statistics that Riley presented, and it's interesting that you tell us that worked to convince the stakeholders that it was a good thing. I think fascinating. Only 82% of decisions, key match incidents, as they described them, correct last season. It would have been great if we were getting statistics like that for the last 5-6 seasons.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems very selective, doesn't it? All of a sudden,
they're saying that an increase to 91% is a great achievement. Imagine that Mike Riley had come and the Premier League publicly released statistics 5 years ago saying the Premier League referees are getting 91% of decisions right. I don't think people would be particularly happy with that, that they're getting one out of every 10 wrong. And remember, this is on their own analysis. So these statistics are being generated by Mike Riley to justify the working of VAR. So he has a person sitting saying that VAR decision was correct.
Duncan, he's also thrown his own referees under the bus there. Because what he said yesterday is, almost one-fifth of all key match decisions in last season's Premier League was wrong. One-fifth. How can that be acceptable? I mean, human error is acceptable because we all understand, you know, referees are insinuating you got more wrong in the field tonight than I have. Now, so we all accept that human error is part of the game. But to produce a statistic like that just to justify VAR is, you know, what the referee's going to think about that.
Yes, and look, the whole statistic making process is questionable. You really, if you want to use these statistics for a proper assessment of, one, whether referees' decisions are correct or not, two, whether VAR is improving those decisions, it has to be done by an independent body. You can't have the people who are implementing the system deciding whether their decisions and their VAR decisions are correct or not, because they're inherently biased. We know Mike Riley is under huge pressure over this. We know that there's dissent from every area of the game over the handling of VAR. Of course he's going to present a statistic that says that VAR is doing a good job. You know, he hasn't gone, fortunately, to the level FIFA did at the World Cup with their statistic that 99.35% of decisions were correct after VAR, i.e. only three of all the goal, you know, the major areas in which VAR makes an assessment during the entire World Cup, FIFA's claim was only three decisions were incorrect. Anyone watching the World Cup knows that's not true. And I think if you were to go back through this Premier League season and get an independent body to assess whether 91% were correct after VAR, I seriously doubt an independent body would come up with 91% being correct.
Well, Duncan, here's the statistic, I think the key one that we're missing, as we've not been told, and that is, what is the percentage of VAR decisions which overturned a referee, which percentage of them were wrong? I.e., can we judge VAR on VAR?
Indeed.
Because was it 29 have been overturned so far after 12 rounds of matches in the Premier League? So where's the statistic which tells us, well, actually, on review of what the VAR decision was, maybe 5 or 6 of those were incorrect, or maybe even 10. So then you've got the 50% of VAR decisions that said were right are actually wrong. Now, funnily enough, we don't have that information, and I doubt very much someone's calculating it right now either, because it's not in their interests. But in saying that, two other pieces of information that came out of yesterday's meeting. First of all, there was a conversation which was had between some smaller clubs. I'm led to believe at least six or seven of the smaller stakeholders who believe that continuing with VAR is in their interest because they feel like, and this is quite comical, they've got a better chance of getting a decision against a top six club if there's, at least there's a review. That, you talk about Anglo-Centric, Duncan, that takes that even greater. And the other one was that after Riley's presentation and during the question and answer session, which Riley then had with the 20 stakeholder representatives, one of the stakeholders near the end of that discussion said, well, look, in light of everything that's happened, I think if we did anything drastic to change VAR now, we're the ones who look stupid. So maybe it's in all of our interest just to get on with it.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see what the lower end Premier League clubs in 2 or 3 years' time, if VAR lasts that long, whether they still think that VAR gives them a better chance of getting a decision against a big six club as they do now. And they obviously haven't been paying attention to things like Real Madrid in the Champions League having goals that were offside reinstated by VAR when they're playing against Club Brugge in the group stages, and Ajax going ahead against Real Madrid in the knockout stages last season and having a goal chopped off by VAR, which most people would have said shouldn't have been chopped off. I think I think down the line, when this has been operating long enough and people have had the chance to do a scientific study, you'll find that VAR favours big sides just as on-pitch refereeing has always favoured big sides.
The one thing I would say about the Champions League VAR is much more efficient, Duncan. Anyone who's been watching Champions League so far this season will probably have seen for themselves that it's much more quick. I'm not saying it's right or wrong or it's any better percentage-wise, but it's certainly decisions are made much more quickly. I think the average decision takes between 45 and 55 seconds, whereas here we're running at 3 minutes. So clearly they're doing something better in terms of at least getting things decided quickly, keeping the game flowing, and making sure that the fans are informed as well.
Yeah, look, I see what Aston Villa chief executive Christian Purslow has said, and he's obviously in the seriously concerned camp, and he's saying clubs have got grave concerns, but so has everybody in the room. Had a very robust discussion. The message has got through to the league and to the Referees Association that fans are unhappy, and many stakeholders in the game think we have to do a whole lot better. And he talks about he expects to see real improvements in the speed of decisions, consistency of which is what everybody craves. And I think above all else, for those of us in the stadium, we want much better communication about what's going on before, during and after. So that shows you the anger, and it shows you that what they're proposing is a path to solve things. My personal view is, even if you implement this stuff, you just result in having other problems. Therefore, it doesn't get solved. And in the end, you conclude the system doesn't benefit the game. There's always a problem with it, whichever way you implement it.
Well, unlike VAR, the quickfire round of a Friday transfer window podcast causes no concern in terms of what the decisions are, or indeed the percentage of the ones that we get right. Because, of course, we always get it right because we are the quickfire round. And today's quickfire round, Duncan, is going to be a comparison of hat tricks, because two significant ones were scored in European qualifying this week. One by England's golden boy, Harry Kane, and one by the golden boy of the world, Cristiano Ronaldo. I put it to you, which one was best?
I think I'm going to go with Cristiano Ronaldo here. And just for the quality of one goal in particular that he scored, and also the numbers that he has put up as a player through his career and his response to some difficult times at Juventus with Maurizio Sarri, is to come out and score three for Portugal and get himself ever closer to that 100 international goal mark, which Sergio Cricinus predicted he would go through. And I think he predicted on the podcast that Cristiano would become the all-time highest international goal scorer before he retires as a player.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, please, if you've not seen it, get it online. Second goal for Cristiano Ronaldo last night. He takes the ball first time on quite a firm pass, sweeps the ball in the far corner. It is just gorgeous. just gorgeous. Two goals shy now of the 100 club in international football, and he's now scored 30 plus goals for club and country for the 13th consecutive year. No other player has achieved that. Just, I mean, you say he's a machine, he's not a machine, he's like a Terminator of football. This has been Friday's Transfer Window podcast. Please join the debate, continue the debate with us at Transfer Podcast on Twitter and also at Duncan Castle at Garbo SJ. As you can tell from our timeline this week, we love to get involved with you. We love to hear your views. And of course, we like to have a wee disagreement with you now and again as well. So don't be shy. Keep it going over the weekend, because we'll be back on Monday and we should see you through the transfer window then. Thanks for listening.